this country is actually facing the possibility of a power grab that would completely erode the electoral process.
Welcome to episode 25 of Inside Without Now, a podcast brought to you by volunteers with Refuse Fascism. I'm Sam Goldman, one of those volunteers and host of this show. In today's episode, we are sharing an interview with Rose Berger, senior editor of Sojourners Magazine, where she writes a regular column on spirituality and justice. I discuss with her her recent article in the November issue of Sojourners, titled, "We Can Help Prevent an Election Crisis. Here's How." But before I share this interview, I want to share a message from the RefuseFascism.org editorial board to everyone who feels the urgent need to end the nightmare that is the Trump-Pence regime. Election Day is upon us. The atmosphere is thick with threats from the Trump-Pence regime that there will not be a peaceful transfer of power, but rather a theft of the election, a continuation, Trump called it. In reality, if they remain in power for four more years, it will be catastrophic for humanity with a leap in their fascist program. At the same time, tens of millions of people are flooding to the polls to defeat Trump, and they are filled with both hope and dread. The stakes could not be higher, and people feel it. Refuse Fascism went into this fall calling for people to take to the streets every day, gathering in the city and town squares. We struggled hard for people to recognize that facing a rolling theft of the election and virulent MAGA caravans, rallies, and outright armed intimidation at the polls requires mobilizing our side, a broad coalition of diverse forces learning, working, and acting together. While most people took to voting for now and said to themselves and us, we'll take to the streets when Trump loses, Refuse Fascism and those who responded to our call made a real impact by disturbing the air with cages that people stayed in downtown LA, dramatizing what is being done to immigrants in our name. And all across the country, in the women's marches and during the illegitimate rubber stamp confirmation hearings of the theocratic, patriarchal Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court, Refuse Fascism organized handmaids to dramatize the stakes of this and the demand, Trump Pence, out now. Now, the elections are upon us. While we can't completely rule out that there will be something that happens that causes the dam to break before the election and millions pour into the street, that is not likely now. And we need to prepare for the momentous struggle if Trump cries the election is a fraud, attempts to shut down counting the votes, or in other ways, nullify the election. To do this, we have a twofold plan. One, to continue from now through Election Day and likely beyond, with making our central gathering places that are magnets for people who want to act. We should continue to develop creative and bold, nonviolent actions that disrupt business as usual and wake people up to the reality that Trump is already stealing the election. We need to vote, but voting alone will not stop Trump. Two, we need to be preparing for the 5 days from Election Day, November 3rd, through Saturday, November 7th. These 5 days are going to be crucial should, as is likely, the Trump-Pence regime moves to steal the election. Trump will demand a winner be declared on election night, knowing full well that Democratic voters who follow the science of how to protect from COVID will have disproportionately voted by mail. They will move to end the counting. Fascist Fox News Network will sow doubt and confusion. MAGA militias and mobs will be in the streets. The first 5 days must not go unopposed. Millions of people must be moved to act. Orders from the regime to institutions responsible for delivering and counting the votes to stop doing so must be ignored and defied. The demand, Trump Pence out now, must be everywhere, and it has the potential to resonate even more widely as a demand against the illegitimacy of the regime's theft of the election. In this situation, and particularly in these first 5 days, there has to be a clear poll, a rallying cry, an expression of feet on the streets that is focused on the single demand, Trump-Pence out now. What will be unfolding before people is that the institutions that they wanted to and did rely on, voting, is, like so many other institutions and norms under this fascist regime, being torn up and subverted by the regime. In this situation, while it will be necessary and right to join in demanding the votes be counted, simply relying on the normal processes of counting could very well legitimize a Trump victory, as he and the Republicans have changed many of the rules of the game and will do so even more. From its founding, RefuseFascism.org has said that a fascist regime, whether it comes to power by fair or foul means, is always illegitimate. This underscores the importance of massive numbers of people acting together in nonviolent protest, not just reactive to the regime's moves or to the democratic leadership's calls to let the process play out, as Biden said in the debate, but to insist on our demand. Then the processes and institutions could be forced to respond, to concede to our demand that this regime must go. Our plan is this: Tuesday, November 3rd, election night, at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, gather together online for a live webinar to watch election projections and returns and hear commentary from RefuseFascism.org editorial board members, hosted by Andy Z and Coco Das, where weather permits, we will watch in the public square. At 9 p.m. Eastern Time, go to the site of daily Out Now protests in the central square for vigils and gatherings to unite, discuss, plan, and organize, and to be ready to take to the streets. Wednesday, November 4th. This is the day that many groups have planned for protests at 5 p.m. Gather people in the square at 4 p.m. with Trump Pence Out Now banners and signs, and march as a group to other planned protests with the demand throughout Trump Pence Out Now. Thursday, November 5th and Friday, November 6th. Stay in the streets to stop a fascist coup and demand Trump Pence Out Now, with bold, creative actions exposing the towering crimes of the Trump-Pence regime and the stakes for humanity if they are allowed to remain in power. Saturday, November 7th. This will be a day of massive protests around the country, a time when we must flood the streets and fill the squares across the country to overwhelm this fascist regime and movement with our numbers and heart for humanity. It's a statement from the RefuseFascism.org editorial board that you can read at RefuseFascism.org. Now, here's my interview with Rose Berger, senior editor at Sojourners Magazine, where we discuss, we can help prevent an election crisis. Here's how, in an article that was published in the November issue of Sojourners Magazine. Well, it is Thursday, the week before what will be, in my lifetime, the most decisive election. I'm really glad that, Rose, you've agreed to be on. We're going to have a conversation that centers around Sojourner Magazine's current edition, in particular, your article, We Can Help Prevent an Election Crisis, Here's How. I think that this is the topic that everyone with a heart for humanity really needs to be considering right now, given all that we've seen. I was really taken when I read this magazine by the focus that it was placing on this election and on the stakes. And you titled your article, We Can Help Prevent an Election Crisis, Here's How. And I was wondering if you could share, what is the crisis that you foresee? Because there's many possibilities, but what are you worried about? And what compelled you to write this article?
Thank you so much for finding Sojourners Magazine and reading us, and for the work that you're doing, and for focusing on this particular piece of our work. The Sojourners is a Christian magazine. We're a progressive Christian magazine. So we're unapologetically Christian in our faith and our roots and where we draw our strength and wisdom from. But we are offering, I hope, a progressive political vision that is really for the common good. We try not to be too partisan one way or the other, although we are always partisan for what we think is the social good, what we think is social justice. So as we look at this election, I think part of the job that we feel like we have at Sojourners is to really discern reality. So that seems like a basic starting point. At points, we had a common shared reality. We had a common understanding in our nation about what was real and what was not. But as we have increasingly moved into such partisan strife and with really aggressive weaponized propaganda, it becomes first our job to discern reality. What is truth? What is factual? And then be able to sort of imply the inherited wisdom out of our own Judeo-Christian background to figure out a way to help point the society forward in a good way. That's sort of a big step back about why we engage in the political moment and the social moment the way that we do. This election, I agree with you completely. It is the most vulnerable election in modern U.S. history. Certainly, as you said, in our lifetimes. And as international observers look at the U.S. election, they indicate that we are meeting some key indicators for social violence. While we are a society that has a lot of violence in it, we have not had the kind of levels of political social violence that other countries have endured quite often around their elections. And some of those indicators are how widespread are the use of arms in civilian hands? So that's one question international observers always ask, and we are meeting that benchmark in the United States. Now, are there non-state armed actors? Well, we've seen a very strong uptick of armed militia groups in the United States that are not paramilitary forces per se. I mean, some of them might be, they might be aligned along with local police, but they are often against the state. Those kinds of groups on the rise is a very serious indicator. The third is the dismantling or the erosion of trust in institutions. And this happens through a number of ways. I mean, sometimes an institution loses trust because it doesn't fulfill its mandate. That's a legitimate question. But the sort of intentional dismantling of institutions in order to privatize the control of them and take it out of the control of the people, that's a different way of understanding that, and the United States is meeting that threshold at the moment. And then the other two are identity politics. How deeply divided is the society around issues of race or ethnicity? And then the fifth is the normalization of interpersonal violence. Right now, those top five indicators, the U.S. is meeting all of them, which makes this election a trigger point for widespread outbreaks of social violence. Sort of the two key areas around that are paralleling each other are both a very contentious election and this deeply embedded and very public police brutality epidemic that we are seeing. And so as the Black Lives Matter movement pushes for accountability, and as we continue to see, like we've seen in Philadelphia, another death, particularly Black men, but Black women also at the hands of the police. And then we see judicial legislation come down that doesn't accord with what we see in the video. These are very dangerous sort of trigger points where we see that violence can break out. And so I think part of as we get back to looking at the article and why we are so concerned at Sojourners about this election right now, if that kind of widespread social violence breaks out, it is so hard to come back from that in terms of rebuilding accountable democratic structures. And so preventing that kind of violence is really critical for a longer term health of a democratic system. So we're sort of looking at all these various scenarios where that kind of violence could break out and trying to figure out what's the best way to give people the tools to respond.
You were talking about it's very hard to bring things back once that kind of violence takes hold, in particular state violence, and whether it's paramilitary or militia, not to use the wrong word, but that sphere, once they're unleashed, it becomes very hard to reel them back in. There was an interesting, I don't know if you heard it, on NPR talking just about this and how the first days after a coup are the most pivotal in terms of how people respond and what the people do or don't do in response. So I think that this is something that people are rightly paying attention to. As I said before, I was really taken by this issue of the magazine and the emphasis placed on people of faith, in particular, people who see themselves as Christian, to take an active role in fighting for democracy as an extension of acting on their faith. I was reflecting with others about the role that people of faith played in the struggle for voting rights. And with voter intimidation, I'm in Philadelphia. Not only has the murder of Walter Wallace Jr. been a trigger point, if you will, but the eyes of the world really are on Pennsylvania, so to speak, in what becomes of this election. Definitely the eyes of people who wish to suppress the vote. And so there is, you know, voter intimidation and voter suppression, places in this country where people are waiting 12 hours in line to place a vote, mail-in ballot boxes being destroyed, dumpsters being marked as ballot boxes, all these things taking shape in a way where we really haven't seen since the times of the KKK. I'm wondering, what role do you feel that people of faith, progressive Christians, need to play right now?
There are some things that we can and all should do. It's not unique to Christians. It's not unique to people of faith. But anyone with a will towards civic concern and protecting our democracy, I would say we have the responsibility to strategically ensure a fair and free election. Americans are very used to exercising our rights, and we're very lax on exercising our responsibilities. And our responsibilities as Americans is to safeguard our electoral system. That's one of our responsibilities. The election, as we look at it right now, it's sort of in three phases. It's the pre-election work to make sure that everyone has the right to vote and is not prevented from accessing their right to vote. It's the voting experience itself and the counting of every vote. And then it's the post-election acceptance of the will of the people in whatever that is. And those three categories, I think people have been working very, very hard, volunteering as election workers, identifying current voter suppression issues and disinformation campaigns and trying to work against those, training to stand up against voter intimidation, and just securing the time for all votes to be counted. Those are some of the things where I see that work happening right now. As Christians, what we can bring to that is we have this biblical mandate that asks us to protect the image of God that is embedded in every person. So every person has that image of God in them. And one of the ways that Christians can contribute to the society is by reminding people that they are made in the image of God and that they have rights and responsibilities that come with that divine face that's in them. Part of the way I see that is that Christians promoting and recognizing the integral role that a transparent and open election has, and really recognizing that the will of the people, as it says in the UN Declaration for Human Rights, the will of the people shall be the basis of the authority of the government. The will of the people shall be the basis for the authority of the government. And in Christian social ethics, we talk about solidarity, which is, recognizing others as our brothers and sisters and working for their good. And also we talk about subsidiarity, which is, letting individuals take their rights and responsibilities and hold them to account for those rights and responsibilities. And this issue of solidarity and subsidiarity, what's decided at the national level, what's decided at the local level, and does it all serve the common good? These are the kinds of sort of ethical questions or the moral frame that Christians can bring to the conversation. And I think are bringing in many ways. But as we know, there's also a strong hijacking of authentic Christianity, and we are having to battle against that as a battle of language and images, as we know.
One question that I've encountered in doing this work to bring to people what's necessary to stop a coup and the role that mass nonviolent protests play. And one of the challenges that I've come across of people of really all ages is oftentimes the question, well,
What difference can protest make? What difference can a nonviolent protest make? And I was wondering, how do you help explain that to people?
Yeah, I come across that question often too. And it's just such a great opening to really talk about, oh, just all kinds of ways that we can engage creatively in our culture. For some of those of us maybe who've been to one too many protests and seen things roll backwards at times rather than roll forwards, I completely agree with folks who question the efficacy of mass protests. I think it is right to question their efficacy. Because as a society, we are not educated and we are not trained in how to defend our democracy. And so we've sort of come to think of, oh, if we just imitate the newsreels that we saw from the 60s, somehow we'll be able to get some sort of political results. So if just a lot of people show up, somehow that will change reality. And we're really not educated in nonviolent strategy. We're not educated in mass civil society movements. We don't know anything about how to do power mapping or power analysis when it comes to large scale nonviolent strategy. And I think part of what I've been learning in this moment where we are right now, where this country is actually facing the possibility of a power grab that would completely erode the electoral process, that it requires a level of nonviolent strategic thinking from us that we haven't been presented with before. And part of what I've been learning is the difference between organizing mass movements for social change around a particular law or a particular social shift versus how you organize to counter a coup. And these are very different strategies that one uses. For a coup, what you want to do, and this goes to those questions that you were asking about, the first few days after a power grab are really critical, because what needs to happen is the broad base of people need to be able to delegitimize the power grabber. So in some ways, whereas social movements, people who are on the streets are often the prophetic front end of a movement, of a social movement, when you are countering a coup, you need the middle. You need to have things that apply to people who don't get involved in politics, who are not really activists. They need to see how they can be involved, and they need to see that their fundamental rights are being violated by the coup grabber, by the power grabber or the coup leader. And I think the other piece of that is that while large social movements and mass protests for social transformation are often about pushing the government to do a certain thing, you want to enact a certain law or whatever, a coup response is withdrawing consent from the now illegitimate government. And that's a different kind of approach. And there are, all kinds of creative ways that people withdraw their consent, and states withdraw their consent, and mayors withdraw the consent of their city to an illegitimate federal government. It's a different angle. But there are very creative ways in which states, cities, local governments, as well as communities of people can say, this government as it stands, it does not reflect the will of the people, and we are withdrawing our consent from it. Whether that's withholding taxes, whether that's whatever it is, withdrawing from federal bureaucracies, there are a whole variety of ways that people are already considering in the event that that's needed. I mean, I think the great thing is, and you've probably read it, the work of Maria Stefan and Erica Chenoweth has helped us understand with their 3.5 rule that you only need 3.5% of the population to engage in these sort of nonviolent disciplined protests in order to change the tenor of the conversation in the country. And so it's not like every single person has to get out there, but you want mass movements that are launched at the right time, that are geared toward the right audience, and that have a clear understanding of both what their ask is and who their mediators are to get to that point, to get the ask fulfilled.
I would say I agree with the need for a critical mass, I think is really important. I just keep going back to the role that delegitimizing that power grab, how essential that component is. And so that the eyes of the world, when the world looks on, they see the righteousness of the people's cause and how that compels or can compel certain other rulers to act in ways that they may not have before. And the role that people play in changing that political equation by showing the illegitimacy of power. I think that we have tremendous examples from around the world to look at. And that's a, it's a beautiful thing. There is something, I think, with American exceptionalism, where people in this country have this belief that works on two fronts. One is that it could never happen here, that such a illegitimate seizure of power would never happen here, that our institutions are too strong. I think is it something that is very palatable in public conversation. People will talk about a coup, but they'll say, oh, but it really couldn't happen. Or the military would, or these assumptions that these other institutions would take over, should that ever come to pass. And I think that's extremely dangerous. And on the flip side, there's the thinking, the exceptionalism that says, oh, yes, other countries stopped it, but we can't. We're too broken. We're too this, we're too that. And I don't think that's true either. There have been tremendous victories for the people that have been won, but it has taken tremendous struggle. And again, when I'm talking about struggle, I'm talking about political struggle so that no one interprets it any other way. It's the frequent disclaimer I made.
Well, and I think that this is where the question that the other part of your question, which is the commitment to nonviolence, comes up. On the left, we sometimes see the exceptionalism clause of, but these are such unprecedented times that we need to resort to violence or have that as an option in order to achieve our goal, which then begins, unfortunately, in my mind, to mirror the power of the far right, which says we have to pick up guns in order to whatever, whatever. And I don't want to argue, you know, one way or the other on those ends, but when you're coming up against the federal government that has the largest military in the world at its beck and call, then you must choose a strategy that can outwit violence. And that requires a disciplined commitment to nonviolence so that you can shift their power. I'm not saying you have to believe in nonviolence all the time. I'm not saying you have to make a commitment to anything. I'm just saying that as a strategy, disciplined nonviolence becomes an incredibly useful tool for always shifting the narrative back around who's the hero here. So the hero of the narrative is always going to be the person who bravely faces the cowardly one with the arms. Because if we have legitimate arguments, we can talk about them without needing to be armed. And I think that's part of what we need to see in any kind of a terrible circumstance, that we have some sort of an overt power grab or a coup scenario, that there needs to be people who are saying, we will, to the best of our ability, we will stay nonviolent because that is what's going to win the war in the long run, if you want to use military language in a nonviolent strategy.
Yeah, I think that these are really scary times. I think that these are truly unprecedented scary times. And we found sometimes that people have avoided talking about the word fascism with us because it's frightening. But the experience proves that the way you stop a coup is by resisting, by mobilizing, by preparing for it, which does mean talking about, and not by waiting until it shocks everyone into some kind of spontaneous action. Can you talk about how you encourage people to overcome the fear that so many do feel in this moment and confront the danger that we're in right now in a way that isn't paralyzing, but that actually enables you to act?
Well, and I think this is exactly the place where people who practice a faith can step in, because, you know, as Christians, our scriptures are sophisticated and wise about the nature of fear. And so the phrase fear not appears, what, 100 times in the Hebrew scriptures. It appears 50 times in the Gospels. It is a strong component of these biblical texts that people become afraid, and that power uses fear to control people and distort their human dignity. So the Bible's filled with questions about how do you break people out of fear? And, you know, usually we fear things that seem beyond our control, that we think will harm us and that we can't do anything about it. And obviously people of faith feel fear just like everybody else, but we've got this ace in our pocket, if you want to say, which is that we have this sense of a God who has a bigger picture in mind. And for Christians, we have this sense that Christians can be brave in challenging injustice, especially injustice by the state, because it's what Jesus did, paid a really hard price for it. But we try to model that kind of bravery in faith. And so, you know, I think most of the time people who are afraid and there is the fight or flight response. And probably for most of us, it's the flight response. We want to ignore it. We want to huddle down. We just want it to go away. And I think, you know, taking constructive action is the best way to begin breaking the sort of shackles of fear, because fear suppresses agency. And so you got to figure out some way to re-access your agency. And in the Catholic tradition, at least, you know, we have this simple process that we use called see, judge, act, and repeat. So you see what the injustice is, or you see what is the root of the fear. You try to learn about it, you confer with other people about it. So therefore, you're building a little bit of community and you're putting some sunlight and air around your fear. And then you judge, what's an action that I can take that pretty directly addresses the people who are, this fear is leaning on most heavily? What's an action that I can take that will sort of strengthen the common good and will bring a sense of return humanity and humanness to the situation, and then carry out that small achievable act, and then evaluate, how did I feel afterwards? Did I produce anything? Was it constructive? Did I make some good relationships? And then take that back to the beginning and do it again. And that is just a very, very simple, it can be, you know, manifested in so many different ways, but very simple way of trying to break that shackle of fear. And it is a process that my experience says generates hope, that if you begin to take those achievable actions in conversation with your partner, your kids, you know, your friends, a small group of others, that suddenly the energy begins to shift and the fear subsides and the sense of hope begins to grow. So it's that smart action for the common good that creates hope. So those are some of the things that I think, you know, they're very simple things that people can do just dealing with the question of fear. But there's this whole other question that you guys are dealing with in a really good way, which is the question of fascism. And noticing that, who's it, Nora O'Donnell, I think last week asked Kamala Harris if Kamala Harris was a socialist. Well, you know, this is sort of the trope that's been used by the extreme right and is coming out of the White House. What I would want to see is, I would like our journalists to begin asking the president, is he a fascist? And I mean that very concretely. If we think it's a legitimate question to ask Kamala Harris if she's a socialist, then I want our journalists to ask our president if he is a fascist. And my understanding of fascism is that it's partly an early 20th century far right political ideology that uses the idea of a strong nation to consolidate power in the hands of a few. And there's all kinds of ways that it does that. But the fundamental thing about fascists is that they do not believe all people are equal. They do not believe that all people are equal. They believe that some people are better than others, and that those better people, those elite, should run things for the rest of us. And that is fundamentally un-American. It's fundamentally anti-democratic. It doesn't have anything to do with how economics are set up or anything else. It is strictly a supremacist view that flies in the face of everything that America stands for. I'm not sure that Trump himself is a fascist. I think he's a megalomaniac aspiring to be an oligarch. I think he sees America as his piggy bank, but he is the perfect pawn for the fascist forces that are operating in the United States. And he is absolutely fine with fascist forces aligning with him and telling him what to do in order for him to keep control of the American piggy bank. You know, I think he has no moral compass. And when fascists offer him political suggestions or a plan for how to make America great again, he is perfectly fine with taking that up. And so that's again, sort of the why I think the work of Refuse Fascism is so useful, because it helps people to really see our current reality, to attend to its dangers so that we can choose smart action and begin to resist it.
You know, you talked about the seeing certain groups of people as subhuman. And the whole foundation of fascism is that it's anchored by this triad of patriarchy, of xenophobia, and of white supremacy. Now, I differ with you on that. I do think it is American. I think it's uniquely, in many ways, American. I'm in a country that was founded on genocide and slavery. I think that it has certain ingredients that make it the most vulnerable to this kind of power. That's not to say that, you know, we need to unite with people who see it differently. I want to work shoulder with shoulder with people that believe in the promise of America or think that fascism is un-American, whereas I do think it's probably quite American. That's the moment that we're in, is that we need to be talking about these things and not having that be like, well, no, this is the definite, no, this person is, no, like, hello, right. Big giant monster, no future, right. Ecocide, it's a real thing. Can you put the stuff aside and let's get together and do this thing? And so I think that that's, to me, one of the most beautiful things about Refuse Fascism is this insistence on challenging people to be principled, to say, do we want a society where there are no democratic rights, where there are no democratic norms, where there are no civil rights, where people are deemed as subhuman, or do we not? That's the dividing line. And if you don't want that, then we got to get together and stop this. And so that's why I'm a part of it, because I think that that kind of bold unity is what's needed. I wanted to talk a little bit about some particulars in your article. You had outlined some of the key ways that you propose people act to ensure that there's no election theft. And it points people to some excellent resources on nonviolence training. And I wanted to just read some of those and talk a bit about them. You wrote, stand up against intimidation. You know, if armed citizens announce a second demonstration near key polling places, you had written that social violence damages democracy and that you encourage people to host trainings and unarmed civilian protection, accompaniment, rumor control, and de-escalation so that community teams are prepared to escort voters safely to and from the polls. And you recommend that people Google hashtag #RethinkSecurityUCP. And you also provide the resources dcpeaceteam.com and nonviolencetraininghub.org for information on virtual trainings. Was there anything particular about that, those tips, that you think is really important for people to know about or to do on Tuesday?
Yeah, I mean, as you said, the danger, in addition to getting every vote counted, is this question of a power grab. And, you know, power grabs happen when people aren't paying attention. But I think right now, many Americans are paying attention. And maybe that's my glass half full perspective. But just the number of trainings that I've been on, I've been in nonviolent trainings for many, many years. And last week, I was on a How to Counter the Coup webinar, and there were 700 people on the call, 700. And that was only one of the webinars. And they were doing, I think, three of those webinars a week for the last 3 weeks. So these are extraordinary numbers of people who are interested in this information, who are interested in democracy defense training, who are interested in anti-violence training. The Episcopal Church in the United States as a denomination is offering de-escalation and nonviolence training to many of its pastors. Other denominations are doing the same thing. Sojourners has a program called Lawyers and Callers, where we pair up pastors with attorneys to be present at the polls to help ensure that civil rights are guaranteed. And all of those pastors and attorneys are being trained in violence de-escalation. This is going on everywhere.
Are there certain places where you feel work like that is being most mobilized. I'm in a state where, as I said before, we're one of the top five high alert places. Are there things in certain states more so than others?
Well, I can speak at least for the Sojourners Lawyers in College program that they are focusing primarily in 8 states, and Pennsylvania is one of them. I can't list them off, but they would be the 8 sort of most contested states where there's a sense that there's going to be an outbreak of violence. I think the things that people can do that are pretty simple, but they are strategically informed. And the first is get your elected officials to publicly promise to count every vote. Now, in a normal election, we don't count every vote. We count the votes that come in at the ballot box, but then if the election seems clear, we don't vote the mail-in ballots. That's been a pretty standard practice. But this election, and because the elections have become so close over the last 10 years, we want to institute elected officials who promise publicly that they will support counting every vote. And we want to remind them of their pledge, and we want them to keep repeating it in public. And if they start to back away, then we're going to hold them accountable. And that's where creative public demonstration comes in and where conflict might escalate. And so then you want people who have some basic skills on violence de-escalation. And then the third part is for people to see themselves as part of a broad-based, nonviolent anti-coup strategy that is in place to protect a pluralistic society and future. The second is these very basic nonviolent skills, such as active bystander intervention. If there's a conflict between two people, don't engage with the aggressor. Instead, creatively engage with the target of the violence and move that person out of the way or out of the scene. So this is just a very basic de-escalation technique. But also, a lot of people are concerned about propaganda and rumor control. That's another piece, especially on social media, that we are keeping an eye on, and that everybody can be an influencer on social media. When you see false information, you don't want to attack the person who is giving the false information. You want to be in solidarity with the audience of that. And you do that basically by making what they call a truth sandwich. You state the fact, then you debunk the falsehood, and then you restate the fact. And aim it toward the audience that's being targeted, not the aggressor that's putting out the bad information. So again, these are like really simple, but very tested things that people can do. And then third is being prepared for that broad-based nonviolent strategy to protect the democracy.
I think that one of the things that I feel is important for people to understand is how much this election theft is already underway and how much has transpired already in terms of trying to delegitimize mail-in ballots, efforts to call things fraudulent that are not fraudulent, the voter suppression, the voter intimidation, those types of things, and the recent Supreme Court move and the very clear positioning to have the cover of lawfulness. The cover of lawfulness, which does make it more challenging in terms of having that immediate response from the people with that clear, this is illegitimate, because it does have that cover of, well, the institution said it was legitimate, therefore it's legitimate. And which is why Refuse Fascism does take the approach that, which I know is different than Sojourners would take for various reasons, but we do take the approach that no election, fair or fraudulent, can ever legitimize fascism, that is always an illegitimate form of rule, even if people voted for it.
Yeah. And I do agree with that, because that's partly what we see time and time again across countries and across history, is that because the concentration of power can manipulate the electoral system, they just simply use that electoral system to maintain their fascist power so that anything that the Nazis do is legal.
I mean, most of the stuff they did was legal. So I think that that's a danger that we face. My last question with you is, we are at a moment where 545 migrant children are orphaned. We're at a moment where Black people continue to be murdered with impunity. 1,000 people a day are dying because of a disease that's been allowed to whip through society, and the planet is literally burning. We could go on all day about the real crisis and human suffering that is happening. I wonder if you have any final thoughts about the energy, courage, and passion that's needed from our side, the side for humanity and the planet, including of people of faith and beyond who don't want to live in a fascist America.
One fundamental piece or aspect or foundational aspect of being a Christian is recognizing that each one of those 545 migrant children is my crucified savior. And so to hold each one of those victims in the posture of the great art, of the posture of the Pietà, in the posture of the Mother of God holding the broken body of her son. That is part of the fundamental way that as Christians, we just lament the human brokenness of the world in which we live. And so I don't want to slide over any one of those 545 children, any one of the 1,000 people a day who are dying of COVID. We spend time with their faces, with their stories, and lamenting our own brokenness that has been complicit, perhaps, in how this has happened. And the prophet Isaiah talks again and again about how it is the oppressed people, it is the brokenhearted people who will be the ones to repair the city. They are called the planting of God. And so it is with our broken hearts and our, as Christians would say, with the wounds of the cross intact is Jesus resurrected. He's not resurrected with no wounds. He's resurrected with his wounds intact. And so it's the mourners who will build up and repair. It's the activists who are showing up to rage against injustice alongside those who mourn. We carry our losses into the streets. We draw from our histories and our spiritual inheritances to say that we will be the ones who will rebuild the ruined nation so that mourners don't mourn alone and that activists don't die alone on the front lines. And one very specific image that I have in my mind is I live in Washington, D.C., and I live about three blocks from Howard University, the historically Black college in D.C. And every day at noon, for the last 4 years, the carillon has been playing Lift Every Voice and Sing, which some people know is the Black national anthem. And it has those lines, you know, sing a song full of the faith that the dark past has taught us. Sing a song full of hope that the present has brought us. Facing the rising sun of our new day begun, let us march on until victory is won. That's my lodestar every day at noon when I hear that carillon sing, play the bells. And that's what I would offer to your listeners and to all of our compatriots. You know, hold your ground, gird your spirit. As the great Catholic Irish Union organizer would say, Mother Jones, pray for the dead and fight like hell for the living. So hold your ground, stand firm, encourage your faith and your spirits, and get ready to rock and roll.
That was Rose Berger on her recent article, We Can Prevent an Election Crisis. Here's how. You can read it in the November issue of Sojourners Magazine at sojo.net. Thanks for listening. Join and help develop bold, nonviolent actions in the town square in these final days before the election that sound the alarm that Trump is already stealing the election. We need to vote, but voting alone will not stop Trump. And be part of preparing for the 5 days from Election Day. Find or host protests and learn more by visiting refusefascism.org. While you're there, be sure to sign up for text and email alerts regarding actions near you. And please click that orange donate button at refusefascism.org to help fund a full-page ad in the New York Times featuring a pledge to the people of the world in the name of humanity. We refuse to accept a fascist America. You can also give via Venmo, refuse-fascism, or via Cash App, Refuse Fascism. Follow at Refuse Fascism on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, and subscribe to this show for the latest. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. See you in the streets.